This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and editors about politics. It's Thursday, January 26th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. One of Donald Trump's favorite campaign slogans was "Drain the Swamp." Now Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer and his colleagues have been raising the issue of Trump's swamp cabinet at every opportunity. Elizabeth Warren, who enjoyed engaging Trump in Twitter wars during the campaign, spoke on the floor of the Senate after the election.
President-elect Trump has now named most of his transition team. So, how is he doing on his rock-solid double-down promise to get rid of the special interests and the lobbyists? Big surprise. Trump is not draining the swamp. Nope. He's inviting the biggest, ugliest swamp monsters in the front door, and he's turning them loose on our government and on our economy. In just 1 week, the president-elect has elevated a slew of Wall Street bankers, industry insiders, and special interest lobbyists to run the show.
James Stewart joins me to talk about Trump and his rapid transformation from sworn populist to plutocrat. Welcome back, Jim.
Thank you. Good to talk to you.
During the campaign, Wall Street, and Goldman Sachs in particular, was a routine target for Trump. He said that Goldman had total control, including total control over Hillary Clinton. He constantly called her out for accepting $675,000 for those infamous speeches at Goldman. Fair enough on that front. But tell us about the Goldman alumni who will be controlling Trump's economic policy.
I want to remind you that he also excoriated Ted Cruz for his ties to Goldman because Cruz's wife had once worked there.
I had forgotten about that.
Don't forget that. But he now has, to a staggering degree, embraced Goldman alumni. There are six and counting prominent appointees so far, sort of in order of influence, I guess. There's Steve Bannon, a Goldman alumnus who's now the chief White House strategist and was a key architect of the Trump political victory. Steve Mnuchin, who not only himself is a Goldman alumnus, but his father was one of the most famous Goldman partners. He's going to be the Treasury Secretary, assuming he gets confirmed, which all indications are that he will. Gary Cohn was the president of Goldman, the number two job, Lloyd Blankfein's right-hand man, and he's going to direct the National Economic Council. But that's a far more influential job than it might seem because his office is right in the White House. Then there's Dina Powell, a Goldman partner who's now been named as a White House advisor, is said to be very close to Ivanka Trump. Jay Clayton, a partner at Sullivan & Cromwell, who has much of his career represented Goldman, has been named to head the SEC. And Anthony Scaramucci, another Goldman alumnus and hedge fund operator, has been on the Trump transition team and has been a key advisor and is widely expected to get another influential job in the administration. And I can't remember another time when one firm so dominated domestic economic policy in a presidential administration.
And why do you think he's done that? Is this partly Bannon's influence?
I don't believe so. From what I'm hearing, it is more Jared Kushner's influence, Trump's son-in-law, who has had warm and friendly ties with Goldman. Unlike Trump himself, who, is, as far as I know, had virtually no business ties to Goldman. And I would say there is at least some reason to suspect that Goldman wouldn't have had Trump as a client because of his previously notorious reputation in banking and investment circles.
What does Wall Street want exactly? We know about the huge deregulatory push across the board. I assume they want to roll back Dodd-Frank, especially the Volcker Rule. Just tell us a little bit about what you expect to see happen.
Yeah, there's no secret here that both Wall Street, the big banks, they absolutely probably tops of their wish list is rolling back Dodd-Frank as much as possible, lifting the restrictions on the ways that they can make money, possibly lowering the capital requirements, which have depressed their profits. That's their bread and butter. More broadly than that, they're big supporters of tax cuts to a point. I don't think most of them want to blow open the deficit quite to the degree that Trump has at times suggested he might do, but they are very big on tax cuts, but more on the corporate tax front, which is something their clients want and which would definitely free up more capital for investment, which is where they make a lot of their money. And then they also, I think, would support the infrastructure spending because that, too, is going to prime the economy, lead to growth, and that generally benefits their trading activities as well as their capital raising activities.
Is that why Michael Bloomberg says that this is a net plus?
I suppose so. I mean, Wall Street is very much opposed to some of the Trump agenda. I think foremost on that would be the protectionist trade policies.
Yeah, that was my next question, which seems completely antithetical to what Trump has been doing in the last couple of days.
Yeah, they are absolutely opposed to that. Another thing that they are completely opposed to is a weaker dollar. I mean, you'd be hard-pressed to find a competent economist who would come out in favor of either protectionism or manipulating the dollar lower. That's anathema to a very wide spectrum of economic thinkers.
And again, getting back to Trump's campaign promises, Jobs was at the core of why he was elected. So if he goes ahead, canceling the Trans-Pacific Partnership, possibly NAFTA, no one believes, as you've just said, that this is going to help the economy or create jobs, do they?
The jobs focus is a little bit puzzling to me, considering that the United States now has essentially full employment. We're at a level where realistically, I don't see the unemployment rate going too much lower. I mean, historically, it never has. So it's really about only a certain kind of employment. He seems to be stressing old world manufacturing jobs that he wants to keep here. The problem with that is, particularly if he seeks that goal through protectionism, is that put up barriers to trade, that raises costs for consumers, that leads to lower consumption, and that's going to lead to lower employment, in theory, across the economy, including ultimately in some manufacturing jobs. I mean, if you're making, you know, washing machines or something here in the United States and they cost twice as much as they did, then, you know, the quantity consumed is going to go down. Mainline economists are scratching their heads to try to figure out what is it exactly that he wants to achieve beyond this sort of symbolic sense that he's out there tilting at this windmill that people feel has caused jobs to flee America.
The media over the last week has focused on various outrages that Donald Trump has perpetrated, lies, his appointees, various other things. Trump voters seem to be standing behind him. At what point, if any, do the scales fall from their eyes?
Well, something that really is going to hit them close to home, because I think the Trump supporters so far have been quite happy with what they're seeing and hearing. I think they are dismissing the ideas of chaos and inconsistency. I don't think many of them are thinking through some of the contradictions here. And the stock market has been going up.
Let's start with that. Why is it going up?
A lot of uncertainty was resolved, and B, the stock market, like Wall Street, loves the prospect of a corporate tax cut. They love the idea of stimulus spending. You know, they've been saying for years that, you know, low interest rates couldn't do it. A Republican Congress wouldn't ever let Obama spend on anything. But now suddenly it looks like they're going to open the checkbook. And Wall Street likes that. They're not worried about inflation. They may be somewhere down the road. But, you know, there are dangers from that. But in the short term, a big surge of government spending is great. They're discounting the idea of a trade war, which, you know, would really be bad news for the stocks. But they don't seem to be worrying about that. So that's gone up. But back to your question, what's going to make people start worrying? Well, I think if you really see it's a trade war taking shape, if you see some international tensions getting really severe, but I think it's going to be domestic economic issues that will finally start to rear up. You see inflation start to take off. But I have to say, those are going to take some time. They're not going to happen tomorrow, the next month, or even the next year.
The Tea Party grew out of middle American rage about the bank bailout, hundreds of millions of dollars to save the big investment firms that have made all those terrible subprime loans, while their CEOs continued to make tens and hundreds of millions of dollars. Talk a little bit about whether Trump's anti-regulatory fiscal policy could possibly bring on another bubble.
Well, there's no question that if he does roll Dodd-Frank back, if he does kind of unleash the banks to do what they want to do, that the risks of excesses creeping in are definitely going to be heightened. I mean, that was the whole point of Dodd-Frank, to try to make sure that this didn't happen again. But memories being what they are, people seem to be forgetting, you know, some of the issues. Now, where Trump really will come down on that is still something of a mystery. I mean, he at one point actually said that, even to go beyond that, that the old separation between traditional banking and investment banking activities should be once again imposed, like the old Glass-Steagall Act that was repealed. So he occasionally will let fly with something that is totally anathema to the Wall Street crowd. But to the extent he's handed domestic economic policy over to Wall Street people, it's very unlikely, I think, that we're going to see any of that kind of regulation materialize. So, yeah, I think there are going to be risks. It won't be mortgage-backed securities again. But I think the one lesson we learned in the financial crisis was that if you just leave markets to their own devices, bad things can happen. You do need regulation. And now that all seems to be kind of a distant memory.
I want to get back just for a second to Goldman Sachs, because one of the rallying cries among the opposition is corruption that is, contrary to Trump's claims during the campaign about draining the swamp, that he's actually going to heighten the possibilities for conflicts of interest.
Goldman has a long tradition of encouraging partners to go into government, to public service, to be on charitable boards. And, you know, while that's laudable in and of itself, let's don't pretend it doesn't have a distinct business advantage there. And what I reported and I know to be true is that, you know, a lot of chief executives have been calling up people, partners at Goldman, calling Lloyd Blankfein, the chief executive there, angling to get a message to Gary Cohn and Steve Mnuchin, trying to see can Goldman. I mean, everybody knows they know each other all so well that if they want to get a message to the White House, they can go through Goldman. And, you know, what better way to get a message than to start using Goldman as your banker? So I think there's Goldman would say there's a virtuous cycle here where they place their people in high positions and then clients flock to the firm because they realize they're a pipeline to people with power.
Jim, you wrote a book some years ago called Tangled Webs, which was about perjury. And I was reminded of that because one of the many subjects under discussion over the last week or two is Donald Trump's lying. But I'd love to get you to talk a little bit about that.
In writing that book, I found it was interesting that I had to kind of go back and do some research into why is it that we value the truth as a society, and why in particular do we make it a crime for someone to lie under oath? I mean, that's something I'd always taken for granted. But even then, people were beginning to kind of ignore that or question it. And, you know, this goes back to before Rome, the importance of having truth be the issues on which major issues are decided. I think we can't accept that as self-evident anymore. I mean, we now have a president who is rampantly lying. And by the way, most of the time he's not under oath, but he has testified under oath in various contexts in which he clearly lied. There were many lawsuits actually involving his casino empire and when he made various statements under oath. They were amply documented in several of the biographies about him in which he clearly did not tell the truth while testifying under oath.
The characters you centered on, Martha Stewart and Bernie Madoff, among others, were brought to justice. Do you think that sooner or later the lies are going to catch up with Donald Trump?
Well, lying, and particularly lying under oath, is very under-prosecuted. But when you're the president of the United States, I mean, sooner or later, I think he is probably going to have to testify. I mean, some lawsuits have already been brought in which they're trying to get access to some of his tax records and other business records. And he may have to testify in some of those things, which would raise that specter. And I think if there are serious issues of perjury that the FBI and the Justice Department would have no choice but to do a serious investigation, I think he would be at some risk. And, you know, it's interesting that Jim Comey, who he's keeping as the FBI director, was the prosecutor in the Martha Stewart case. He has been tough on this and understands the importance of this. I mean, I'm personally, as a citizen, I'm glad that he's going to be staying on the job.
Well, and presumably he wants to restore his former reputation.
He's getting it from all sides. There was a scathing editorial denouncing him in the Wall Street Journal yesterday that I think kind of typifies the way public opinion has risen up against him, both on the left and the right. There are some issues there. But I've interviewed him. I know him well enough. I know how important he holds the rule of law. And the rule of law cannot persist if we do not have the law enforcement officers who respect the truth. And need I remind everyone, the President of the United States is the highest law enforcement officer in the country.
So finally, let's talk about Trump's federal tax returns. I think you were the first to speculate that he likely has paid no taxes for recent years, perhaps decades. Now there's a petition out there demanding that he release his returns and that Congress pass a law to force all presidential candidates to do that. What do you think he's hiding?
I initially thought, as you mentioned, I wrote that it was highly probable that he paid little or no federal income tax. And I think we now know to pretty much 100% certainty, although we haven't actually seen the returns, that he did not pay any federal tax in many years and possibly for decades. I thought that's what he was hiding. This seemed to be the obvious thing. You're running for president. You don't pay any taxes. I mean, frankly, I thought that would have been fatal to his candidacy, and I suspect some of his advisors did, too. It turned out, inexplicable to me, that it didn't seem to have much effect. But nevertheless,
I have to interrupt you there because former New York Mayor Giuliani called him a genius for exploiting the law so effectively, which was an amazing moment. And it turned out that they had the last laugh on this.
Well, I guess they did. I mean, genius. I his accountant told, you know, a Times reporter that in the days when he was doing his returns and racking up some of these giant losses that sheltered his income for so many years, Trump barely looked at the return. He just signed it. It was his previous wife, Ivana, who would actually ask more questions about the taxes than Trump did himself. So I don't think Trump himself is a tax genius. I think he was happy to take the results that he got. I mean, I'm familiar with some of the tactics that he used, and I think they're very troubling. I mean, one was a loophole. The issue went all the way to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court, thanks to then Justice Scalia, let it go through. When I think 90% of the tax experts would have been embarrassed to even make the argument. It was shocking that it survived the legal challenge, but it did. And it was so outrageous that Congress, even a divided Congress, promptly closed that loophole and passed legislation saying, no, you can't do that. Does that show a commitment to the well-being of this country? Is that what you would want a public servant to do? I mean, that's what I found so troubling. But, you know, I guess I was in a minority on that. Other people, like, bulldozed right through that and decided that, oh, yeah, it just shows how smart he is.
Thank you so much, Jim.
Pleasure.
James Stewart is a New Yorker staff writer, a columnist for the New York Times, and the author of many books, including Tangled Webs, How False Statements Are Undermining America, From Martha Stewart to Bernie Madoff. This has been The Political Scene from The New Yorker. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app. You can find more political analysis and commentary on NewYorker.com or on the New Yorker Today app, a great way to read The New Yorker on your mobile device. Available at no extra charge from the App Store or at newyorker.com/today. Tell us what you thought of this podcast. Rate and review The Political Scene on iTunes. This podcast is produced by Alex Barron and Jill Dubuff for newyorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.